ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Jan Grabowski's talk, Hunt for the Jews, Betrayal and Murder in German-Occupied Poland. The talk was the Ottawa Historical Association's January lecture. You can find recordings of other talks at ActiveHistory.ca.
Thank you, Andrew, very much. Thank you for this invitation, and thank you for coming to this lecture. I want to also greet all of you as a member of History Department, and I hope that our association with the Ottawa Historical Association will be long and fruitful, and that you will not be a stranger to this campus in the near future. Now, usually, as you know, North American lecturing tradition is... There should be a joke, there should be a witticism. Unfortunately, in my line of work, it would not be apropos, and perhaps Holocaust scholars are the only ones who tend to shy away from the witticism. Although, actually, there are exceptions from this rule, too, but so I will not have many, as you will find out soon why, many witticisms. Nevertheless, the topic will speak for itself. Now, among us here, I see several of my students from years past and the current year, too. And I want right away to apologize to them if there's something that I already said to them in class will be repeated once again, because they, of course, are my testing ground. So when writing a book, I will occasionally refer to my research. So my apologies if you hear something you have heard before. Now, to plunge into the topic without further ado, and I know there is so many things that I want to mention. I will just mention some of them, and then we can discuss... we can discuss it further once we get to the discussion part. So, basically, I want you to visit with me a distant country, Poland. Poland under German occupation. Most of you have more than a vague idea about the area. Now, more specifically here, I would like you to reflect on some numbers and not only numbers. Now, before the war, Poland was home to something close to 3.3 million Jews. In other words, the largest Jewish community in Europe, so home to Jews for hundreds and hundreds of years. Not a very well assimilated, mind you, minority. A minority to the tune of about 10% of the total Polish population. So if you have a nation of about 33 million people, 3.3 out of them are Jews. Once again, most of them not assimilated, meaning their Polish, if any, is very halting, okay? The way they dress, the way they speak, the way they eat, the way they breathe is very different from what you will see in so-called mainstream society. I'll come to this in a moment. Now, our knowledge of the Holocaust comes, for the most part, if you look at what you were reading, seeing, and listening to, comes from survivors. Most of the time, either at school or in TV, in the media, you are listening to an account or many accounts of Jews, of survivors, who will share their story with you. Now, I would like you to remember that if you look at the history of the Holocaust, it's the history of unsurvival. Okay, so in other words, if you listen to the accounts of survivors, it is close, it resembles something, if you would like to make your opinion about wealth in Canada, analyzing people who won a lottery. To give you perhaps more here proximity to the topic, if you look at these 3.3 million Polish Jews in Poland before the war, come September 1939, perhaps 300,000 will flee to the east, perhaps more, but overall, between 1939 and 41, close to 3 million Polish Jews will find themselves under German rule. Okay, so about 3 million Jews will find themselves in the most tragic circumstances under German rule, either 39 or in 1941, once the Germans will push to the east. Now, question to you, or rather question and a quick answer. what is the horizon of survival for these 3 million Jews who found themselves, Polish Jews, who found themselves under German rule. Well, about 40,000 survived. In other words, you have a chance of 1 in 100, which actually gives you a pause. If we are talking about, of course, there were many more who survived, but they were Jews who fled to the East, who were never taken over by the German Reich, who were fled to the East, were deported to Siberia. You can say, irony of history, in order to survive, you had to be transported all the way to Siberia. So in any case, if you were a Polish Jew who had this misfortune of finding himself under German rule, your chance of survival was to the tune between 1 and 1.5%. So if we are building our knowledge of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, on the basis of our encounters with survivors, indeed, well, we have to be very, very conscious of the fact that we are dealing with quite extraordinary, exceptional people. And either it was knowledge of rules or luck, or perhaps one and the other, it changes nothing, that we are not hearing the voice of 99% who never had the chance to tell their story. Well, my book is an attempt to look at these voices of these 99% of people who never made it, but who could have made it. Now, furthermore, if you to tell you what I was looking more precisely at, I was looking basically at these Jews who really made everything in their capacity, human capacity, to survive. In other words, I am looking at the people on something that we call the margins of the Holocaust. Now, you can ask yourself, why should we be bothered with margins of anything? Well, because these margins are very, very broad, unfortunately. What I call margins of the Holocaust are these Jews who actually undertook a very courageous thing. They fled during the liquidation of the ghettos. They fled. They wanted to blend with the Aryan society. They went to the forest. They went underground. They went into hiding. Now, historians today agree that in ethnically Polish territories, about 10% of Jews tried to make this last stand. Now, this is, of course, not a precise number, but it gives you more or less an idea. So if in 1942, when the so-called Endlösung, or the final solution, went into full swing, when the machine of death went into its overdrive, there were probably around 250,000 Polish Jews, and I'm not talking about Lithuanian or Belarusian or Ukrainian Jews, there were probably around 250,000 Polish Jews who went for it. In other words, they escaped from death trains, they fled the liquidated ghettos, they wanted to blend with the mainstream population. Now, out of these people, how many survived? You already know the answer. Between 30 and 40,000. So my research question that each of us as historians ask, we have this guiding research question is, well, in this case, what the hell happened to 200,000 people who really tried desperately to make it and they never did? So this is the margin, okay? Well, you can ask yourself, is it important? Well, this is very important because these people had a fighting chance, okay? They had a fighting chance, sometimes until very the end, to survive. And not many, as you heard, made it. Now, in the second part of my inquiry is that if you look at this part of the Holocaust, you can see that this is when the Germans had much less to say about who lived and who died. For one simple reason. Once the Jews took off their armbands with Star of David, that was the preferred way of branding Jews in occupied Poland, once they went underground, the Germans had absolutely no idea, or very little idea, how to find them. In other words, the Germans needed active support of parts of local non-Jewish or local Polish or other Aryan, so to say, population in order to find these Jews and to deal with them accordingly. because, of course, we know it very well, for Germans finding these Jews and killing them was one of priorities until the very last days of the Third Reich. And this is a phenomenon, of course, which we could discuss at length why, but this is not the object of our meeting. So, to look quickly at the periodization, at how this situation changed in Poland, occupied Poland at that time. One of the most learned and famous scholars of the Holocaust, Raoul Hilberg, created or divided the so-called actors of the Holocaust into three segments. One were perpetrators. True, clear, we know it. Second were the victims. True, simple, we know it. And third group, identified by Hilberg, were so-called bystanders. So everybody else. Now, bystander in English language implies certain, let's say, detachment, certain aloofness, neutrality, if you will. Now, this particular term, bystanders, has been put to questioning recently, and my study is a part of this questioning too. Even if we can find bystanders in Western Europe, which is difficult, but it's possible, Jews from Western Europe were isolated, taken away, and they were murdered beyond the immediate horizon of West European public opinion and audience. Now, nothing of the sort occurred in Eastern Europe, and now this is something that often is forgotten. Holocaust in Eastern Europe was public, was brutal, and was in everybody's face. I mean, there was no possibility for you to be a bystander. You had to have some kind of emotion. You had to be inactive. You could be active, but you could not be standing by. And you will see more about this as we go. So here you have the triad, Hilberg's triad, which is being put to questioning by people like myself, and not only. Now, the second is periodization. First of all, in 1939, the Germans attack Poland. The battle, as you know, doesn't take a long time. After 1 month, Poland is even shorter than 1 month, is defeated. And what ensues from Jewish point of view are 3 years or 2.5 years of sheer terror. We have no time to go through the stages. The important part is that very early on, Jews are brought to the ghettos, and then they are undergoing this terrifying process of terror that the Germans put in place very early on and accelerate on increase from month to month. So this is the third stage, ghettoization and terror. And this stage in Poland will last until early mid-1942. Now, in mid-1942, the Germans move, and I do not use a consciously term Nazis, because there were very many non-Nazi Germans taking part in the whole process. And the Germans move to the second stage of the Holocaust, which we can say, we can call Aktion Reinhardt. Aktion Reinhardt is simply liquidation of the ghettos. This is the time when millions of Polish Jews are herded into killing sites that you know, heard of, Treblinka, Chełm, Sobibór, Bełżec, Majdanek. Now, this process will start with Bełżec in March 1942 and will go through late fall of 1943. During this year and few months, you will have 90% of Polish Jews murdered in these killing sites. And then you have the third period, which starts at the same point in mid-1942 and lasts until the very last days of German occupation, which in terms of Polish territory is January 1945. And this is the period of time which the Germans referred to as Judenjagd. I wanted to keep the title of my book in German, but kind people from Indiana University Press told me that American audience will not suffer a German word on a title, so it translates very easily to Hunt for the Jews. And Hunt for the Jews was to last until the end of the war, as I mentioned, and this is the object of my study. Now, the thing is that inside the Hunt for the Jews period, I could find easily two parts of it. Once again, historians are obsessed with chronology. There you go. One part is the Judenjagd, the hunt for the Jews that occurs during the initial liquidation of the ghetto. First hours, minutes, hours, and days. And that's when the Germans are present. They are in the ghetto. They are liquidating the ghetto. They have special forces called the Liquidierungskommando, which are trained troops, specially trained to do exactly this kind of work, if we can call it this way. And they have Ukrainian, Latvian, other helpers. I will talk about them in a moment later on. They have Polish so-called blue police. They have many, many, let's say, collaborators. They have many people willing to chip in other words. These are the moments of horror for the Jews, because the ghettos are liquidated in a, not brutal, extra horrifyingly brutal way. And when I say that, in case of locality I will discuss in a moment, literally streets were running with blood, it's not a licentia poetica, it simply reflects the fact. Streets were running with blood to the point that Polish magistrate had to send carriages with sand to cover blood next day after the Aktion, after the German action. Okay, now this is the first stage, and still pulling out, the Jews still don't understand that this is the end, and they don't understand that final solution is actually final. It's not easy to understand that you have no chances for life. So the solution is they want to hunker down. They build bunkers. They very ingenious bunkers. Actually, entire Polish, Jewish, so to say, countryside, ghettos for the most part, are being now in a process of houses are being now transformed into sort of a cachette. People are building double walls, are digging bunkers under their basements. The idea is you hunker down, you wait for the bloody Germans to go away, and simply you will emerge a day or two, three, five, 6 days later on, and there will be a new day to live. Once again, the idea that the final solution is final still does not resonate very well. Now, at this stage, you have Jewish police, vicious. You have Polish blue police, vicious. You have German Liquidierungskommandos. You have people who simply, Aryans, who are running into the liquidated ghettos. Why? Because they want to rob. They want to steal. Greed is I found out, a very powerful motivating emotion. So you will have people entering these Jewish in Polish, there's a special word. It's called mienie pożydowskie, which means ex-Jewish property. So if you have a chance to get some of this ex-Jewish property, well, wouldn't you? Perhaps you wouldn't. Perhaps you would. I don't know. We never know these things until a situation. Perhaps you're dirt poor and your family is starving of hunger. Perhaps you will do different things. In any case, what happens is then they will pull out these Jews, hidden Jews. They will find them. So this is the first stage. And here the Germans use local facilitators, but they don't really desperately need them. They can really do the job themselves. However, once the Jews disappear in the area, once they flee to the forests, once they will hunker down in Aryan households, once they perhaps they will buy themselves false doctored documents. Now, from the German standpoint, and if they are not dressed as Jews, well, the Germans are lost. And that's at this point that the Germans will develop a new technique how to find the Jews, because they want to have a good account of each and every Jew, and they want to murder them. Now, and this is something that I apologize to my students because they know it already, in order to show you how difficult, how desperately difficult it was to survive in Poland as a Jew, I will give you a few examples. I mean, you can say, for instance, any of you, let's say you are moving on the surface, as they were called, passing as Aryans. Now, in case of men, detecting a Jew is very easy. You simply ask them to lower their pants. Once they have done it, the truth is revealed, right? And in the case of women, of course, the situation is vastly more problematic, and the hunt goes on. throughout 1942, 43, 44. You have 3 years to contend with, okay? Now, the thing is, it's not only your circumcision. This is, of course, this is just the beginning. The thing is, you have to have a right accent. You have to know how to dress. You have to know how to eat. As I mentioned on many occasions, for instance, if I am looking for Jews, and very many people were earning their money this way, I can ask, for example, a blonde woman, very un-Jewish looking, tell me exactly what are you eating at Christmas Eve? Well, she won't know. Or perhaps can you tell me a prayer, or two, or three? And what do you do, for instance, in church at this point in time or other point in time? And, for instance, why your hair is dark? And, I mean, there are so many questions of language. Why are you asking so many questions? Because Jews are asking questions. Perhaps you are Jewish. I'm now trying to tell you how many stereotypes there were and how many of them you had to bypass in order to survive. And very few people actually knew how to deal with these issues. Just recently I learned from one peasant I was interviewing in southern Poland who told me, oh, it's easy, you know, a Jew. I can detect always a Jew by the way he strikes a match. And I said, how would you know how a Jew strikes a match? Oh, it's simple, because, you know, Jews are cowards, so Jews will light match like this. And Poles will like it like this. So I'm just giving you these these little examples to show you how problematic and how difficult it was. Now, the thing is that in my quest, I decided to look at one small county that I will come to discuss. I don't have much time, and I haven't even started yet. So the thing is that in order to find voices of dead people, I went after new kind of historical evidence which has been on the market, so to say, accessible in Polish archives, so just for a few years, okay, 5, 6, 7 years. And they are so-called August files. August files are massive trials, about 40,000 trials, held in Poland between 1945 and 52, 55 sometimes, mostly in late 1940s, against people, I quote, collaborators with Nazi Germany. And so you have thousands of trials, and you have thousands of people who hurt the Jews. Now, the Polish judicial system went after them because by hurting the Jews, they were facilitating the policy of the Third Reich, which was the total extermination of the Jewish people in Poland. Therefore, Polish citizens who facilitated such a policy stood, had to confront, or sometimes very infrequent, of course, occasions were confronted, had to face the court. And then I have Jewish relations preserved in certain archival fonts and German sources. Now, the thing is that my attempt was to go to shy away from huge numbers. You have heard the numbers, 6,200,000, and so on and so forth. I wanted to look at the individual experience, and this is a citation that actually I found out much later, but I really would like to share it with you. It's from a book that I think everyone should read, Daniel Mendelssohn's The Lost, Searching for 6 out of 6 Million. If you have a chance, I really recommend the book very highly to you. And he writes, everything that happened because someone, an individual, made a decision. Holocaust is so big, the scale of it so gigantic, so enormous, that it becomes easy to think of it as something mechanical, anonymous. But everything that happened because someone made a decision to pull a trigger, to flip a switch, to close a car door, to hide, to betray. And he finished, this is what adds to the record of historical facts the invisible dimension of morality. So in order to find this invisible dimension of morality, we have to look these victims and perpetrators and so-called ex-bystanders, we have to look them in the eye. And you will look them in the eye in a moment too. So I chose a county, okay, a little county. If you look at pre-war Polish maps, here you have Germany, here you have Eastern Prussia, here you have USSR, here you have Slovakia, Czechoslovakia, and my area, so to say, is here. So now you can ask me, why have I chosen this particular county? Well, the response is I could have chosen any other. I was working in Krakow archives, and Basically, I could go for any other county in the area. I went for this one, which was a matter of, I had some more documents, but not that many more than I had from Jehov County or any other county from that area. So the problem is that what I describe is actually something that applies to a larger probably number. But in order to ascertain whether it applies to a larger number of areas, I'm conducting now a larger research. I just started it in several areas of occupied Poland, trying to test whether my findings from this particular area hold water in other areas. So what you have here is the small county, it's about 66,000 people. Rural area. This is important. I wanted to look at rural area. You have small towns, you have villages. It's a rural area. 66,000 people live in the county in 1931, and about 5,000 Jews, which is slightly less than national average of 10%, but still you have a sizable Jewish minority. The capital of this county, a small town, Dąbrowa Tarnowska, about 6,000 inhabitants, half Jews, half Poles. That's about the ethnic or racial mix. Now, the curious thing is that this area of Poland is one of few areas where Jews were not actually artisans small-time merchants. It's an area where the Jews were actually also farmers. You have here, it was actually very for me very fortunate because I wanted to see these Jewish farmers are just Jews peasants. You don't have many Jewish peasants in Europe because especially in Tsarist Russia, Jews could not own land, right? This was the only area where they, since mid-19th century, could own land, and they did. So you have dirt-poor, for the most part, dirt-poor Jewish peasants who live among dirt-poor Polish peasants, and they are neighbors, okay? Well, they don't intermarry, but they know each other very well. So I wanted to see how it translates, how this closeness translates at the moment of life and death into certain choices. So to speed forward, because I am already here half an hour and I don't have much time left, so I have some time left, hopefully. So what happens here is that by 1939, September 1, German armies invade. It takes them about 10 days to reach this area. They take it over and they will stay here until January 1945. Why is it important? Well, it is important because on the 17th of September 1939, as some of you know, Allied Soviet forces move from the east and occupy second part of Poland, basically splitting the country in two. Western part of Poland is occupied by the Germans. Eastern part, for the time being, is under Soviet occupation. Now, the thing is that my area was firmly under German control. Why is it important? Because in Polish historiography, you will find, and not only Polish, Ukrainian perhaps much more so, you will find very often explanation, well, you know, bad things happened to Jews, but Jews had it coming. The reason why would the Jews have it coming? Because they collaborated with the Soviets. Because they invited the Soviets when they arrived. They betrayed their country. Well, here it doesn't apply. However silly this explanation might be, elsewhere in our county, the Soviet forces simply arrived in January 1945. There was no occasion for Jews to, let's say, alienate non-Jews through their lack of loyalty to the pre-war Polish Republic. In any case, very quickly, the situation, as in the rest of Poland, for local Jews becomes miserable. They are being, of course, robbed. Now, one of the goals of German administration is to rob the Jews, rob them in every single possible way. There are too many of these ways, and I don't have more time. Believe me, there are very many ways in which Jews were despoiled of their generations of their wealth, sometimes very small wealth. Whatever they had, it was taken away from them. In Dąbrowa, you have a ghetto, about 4,000 Jews squeezed into few city blocks, town blocks, wooden houses. It's not a ghetto that you might think with huge walls, with barbed wires. No, there is one fence, a wooden fence. If you want to leave, you leave. The question is not whether you can leave, because you can leave. The question is what to do once you have left. And nobody practically leaves because there is a very, very, very unhelpful and a very, very terrifying world out there beyond the ghetto fence, not even ghetto walls. By 1941, the Jews are dying of hunger, of starvation, and there is disease. It's a normal ghetto story: death by famine, by starvation. And then comes 1942. In 1942, the German plans have already been drawn up. The final solution will become the policy of the state. Now, in the case of this territory, it happens earlier than somewhere else, because the extermination camp at Bełżec, which is not far away, it's about 1 hour by rail from this area, opens for business in March 1942. By April 1942, the Krakow Jews will be already slaughtered. Lwów Jews will be slaughtered. Now, the Germans begin very wisely by decapitating the Jewish society. How do they do it? Well, in April they have so-called Intelligenzia Aktion, which translates into action against intelligentsia. They murder in the ghettos all people who are likely to become leaders of their communities. In this case, they arrive with a list, they shoot 40 people, or they throw them off balconies. And in any case, making certain that there is no leadership in the months to come, because they know what is going to happen in the months to come. And what happens in the case of this little town, Dąbrowa Tarnowska, is that the first news comes from everywhere around. The Jews are hearing terrifying stories. They hunker down. They hear Tarnów has been liquidated, as they call it. The Germans have special terms for it, horrible terms: Juden Evakuierung, Juden Reinigung, cleansing of the Jews, evacuating the Jews. Of course, you know what they mean. Now, the Jews hear these stories. They don't want to trust them. They don't want to believe in these stories. Now, suddenly something changes in the little rural urban landscape of this county. In July 1942, suddenly the Germans round up all those Jewish farmers who until then still could exist outside the ghettos on their small farms, and they bring them together and they dump them into the ghetto. Because 2 weeks later, in mid-July 1942, the ghetto will be liquidated. And this is the phenomenon of so-called Aktion, action. Aktion is the liquidation, this extra brutal liquidation of the ghetto. Horrifying story, public affair. Entire town resonates with gunfire. The Germans want to make example. They basically state Jewish life is absolutely worthless. Okay? If you help them, Aryans, Poles, you will be killed too. Watch out. Jewish life is worth absolutely nothing. So it's public affairs, blood in the streets. People are herded from the ghetto, and then they are run to the railway station, from which trains will take them to Bełżec extermination camp, where during over 1 day, the entire population of Dąbrowa, Jewish population of Dąbrowa, will be murdered. Now, the thing is that this is the time when of horror, and that's when the Germans have to develop quickly a new policy of Jew hunt. And how do they do it? So once again, they have deported, let's say, 90% to the gas chambers of Bełżec. By the way, there is only two people who survived Bełżec extermination camp. Now, this little note I found actually in German archives, it is a sort of a rare note, perhaps the only existing one. Translating from the Polish, it is dated August 28, 1942, from a location next door, so to say, to Dąbrowa. Community office in Kośmice Wielkie to the village elder in Janowice, small village. Very urgent. I quote, "Regarding the regulation issued by the county authorities on August 14, 1942, and concerning the deportation of the Jews from our area, I hasten to inform you that the matter is very serious. You are to make absolutely sure that not even one single Jew, Jewess, or Jewish child is left on the territory of your commune," commune being a little administrative unit of about 20-30 villages. You have to immediately order the hostages, I will get to this, to search the entire area, back alleys, bushes, and so on, in order to make certain that no Jews are left. Whenever caught, the Jews are to be delivered to the nearest station of the Polish police. I will get to it too. I repeat that the penalty for hiding Jews is death. Village elders are also responsible for Jews hidden on the territory of their commune. And, in case of negligence, they can face death penalty too. I remind you to make certain that these orders are being followed. You are responsible under the penalty of death. Kośnice Wielkie, August 28, 1942. Now, what you have here is a document which basically reflects new German policy. It is a policy that, of course, you will see of terror and also of certain, let's say, reward. In other words, they want to pull as many Poles into the hunt as they can, using all the possible means at their German disposal. First of all, they are dealing with Wójt. Wójt are officials, Polish officials, who are chiefs of local administration on the level of about 30, 40 villages. Okay, they are normal people, usually without higher education, but trustworthy state officials, we can call them. They are the ones who are sending out these notes to village elders. Now, village elders are in extraordinary bad situation. Village elders are simple peasants, who are peasants usually somehow respected by their peers, because these are elected officials in their village. So in other words, a village elder has to have some kind of respect, because before the war, they would be elected to the position of village elder. Now, once the Germans arrive, they say, look, you are elder, and you cannot leave your post, under penalty, of course, of death, as for so many other things. So you have to basically toe the line, because we know who you are, we know where you live, and you are responsible, we know where to find you. Then what they do, what the Germans then do, is they say, each and every village, starting in mid-1942, has to put in place special force, so-called night watch. In other words, local peasants will be asked to look for Jews. And if they don't look well enough, and the Germans will learn from their confidential reports that they will get eventually from these areas, well, they will have to look for the Jews. So each village will have, let's say, 5 or 6 peasants, depending on the size of the village, perhaps 10 if you have a large village, and they will have to patrol the area. And they know in a little place, in a little village, you cannot hide much. The thing is, if you have Jews hidden in your household, perhaps you will draw one more bucket of water per day from your well. Well, if you have a very intelligent, or not even so intelligent, neighbor, they will find out why Grabowski is drawing one more bucket of water. He must have someone hidden in his household. Or he was carrying a newspaper. Well, my goodness, who knows how to read? Certainly a Jew must be hidden in his area. In other words, you have night watches that will prowl the area, and the Germans organize them, but they are now running on their own already, under their own, let's say, strength. Now, the Germans give to each village one carbine, one gun, and some bullets. So normally these peasants will be armed with pitchforks, but at least one of them will have a firearm too. Now, in order to make these peasants more somehow motivated, the system foresees hostages. Hostages are, let's say, I will tell as a village elder, the Germans don't have to do anything more. They have set in place a system which is now self-running. Basically, me as our, at this point, the village elder, I will appoint, sir, you and you and you as hostages. In other words, if something happens, and you better make certain that the night watch is really working overtime, because if I hear, or if the Germans hear, that the Jews are in our village, hidden somewhere, then this is your problem. And I will give your name, sir, and your name to the local post of gendarmerie, and they will deal with you accordingly. So you are very motivated. If there is a manhunt organized, you will make certain that your neighbors are participating in the manhunt, because you are the hostage. Now, you are being appointed a hostage for 2 weeks, let's say, and then you are free, and I will turn to your peers. There are many people around. And so I, as a village elder, I have to appoint these hostages, and this is the way the system will work. And then you have firefighters. Firefighters who are used throughout, and all I tell you has not been noted in any historical article. This came to me as a complete, the integrity and the complexity of the system, its hellish efficiency, as you will probably not see, it was something quite astounding. And at the end of it is Polish Blue Police. And here I don't have much time left, so I'll just tell you that Polish Blue Police is one more of those nebulous forces that have not been given any practically play in history, and this is something that I'm currently, let's say, working on. Now, the thing is that that Polish Blue Police is simple Polish police under now German rule. Now, the problem is that these people very often combine sometimes even patriotic zeal with anti-Jewish activities, namely murdering the Jews. And these blue policemen, they know very well where the Jews might be because they are from the area. They are usually peasants from local area. They have their families in the area. And if they don't know, then someone will tell them sooner or later. And they are deadly efficient. One of my findings in the book on the basis of this county is actually that Polish blue police was more efficient in tracking down the Jews and murdering them, not even telling the Germans. So without, not only without the German order. The thing is, they were murdering the Jews in order, as they said, to protect Polish peasants. Because had the Germans learned, they would have burned the village. I will just, here what you see is a small detachment of, here you have two German gendarmes, and here you have their friends, Polish blue policemen, from a little station in next to Dąbrowa, a little town next to Dąbrowa. And I will just quote to you one document from one interrogation from 1946. Jan Szewczyk, a policeman from the Otwinów detachment, is standing here, described the last moments of 18-year-old Salomea Sus and her 20-year-old sister, who had earlier been betrayed by Jan Augustyniak from Gorzyce. I quote from the document. Commander of our detachment, Lewandowicz, and this is this fellow here, Commander Lewandowicz said to me and to the young officer Stachowicz, I quote, since you have done nothing yet, now you have to fix them, which meant that I and Stachowicz had to kill the Jewesses. I told him that since I hadn't shot anyone yet, I didn't want to shoot the Jewesses now. So then he told me that I was an ass and not a policeman. Then he turned to the Jewesses and ordered them to get off the road and to go to the bushes nearby. So at this point, the young policeman Stachowicz fired off one round from his carbine. One of the girls fell to the ground, and the other cried out and rushed toward the lying Jewess. At this point, I fired a shot at the second Jewess, and she shouted even louder. Seeing this, Commander Lewandowicz said with irony, "What are you screwing around?" It meant, why hadn't we finished the Jewesses off right away? So the commander approached the lying Jewesses, took out his pistol, and shot them twice, and they were still. I would also like to add that before the shooting, the commander told Dulka, one of the peasants, to dig a grave for the Jewesses. Now, as I mentioned to you, it is a question of not of numbers, of individuals. And most of these individuals are not easy to locate. The closest I could get you to both sisters that were executed by policemen in this area is their exhumation in December 1945, the only picture of these two women, girls, I was able to find. Now, I don't have any more time, so jumping right to the conclusion. If there is a conclusion, basically what I can say are two citations. One of them is from the same document that you have heard before, the book by Daniel Mendelssohn. And let me just see if I have the right page. He writes, "A notorious problem of translation arises in the Cain and Abel story," writes the author of The Lost. I quote, "What the Hebrew text actually says at one point is, 'The voice sound your brother's bloods are crying to me from the ground.' The strange Hebrew of the biblical text suggests quite vividly that even after it's shed, screams of innocent victims do not cease to issue from the earth where their blood was spilled. And ending the story here, we can ask ourselves, what made people participate in this hunt for the Jews? Greed, perhaps. Hate, perhaps. Can they be sufficient explanation for massive involvement in these actions? I don't know. But what is certain is that the complicated multi-layered system invented for the needs of Judenjagd, of Jew hunt, ensured that each inhabitant, each man, woman, and a child, had a role to play in this horrible theater of death. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Jan Grabowski's talk, Hunt for the Jews, Betrayal and Murder in German-Occupied Poland. The talk was the Ottawa Historical Association's January lecture. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.